Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. The Inner Game is about how we nurture and attend to our mind, body, spirit health, and how that allows us to make a bigger contribution in the area of purpose that calls to us. Because these are times that are asking us to evolve beyond the systems and paradigms that are collapsing. These are conversations with people who are committed to making an evolutionary difference with their lives from a place of balance and love and service. My guest today is Paul Anderson. When I moved to Crested Butte in 1987, Paul's name was well known there because he'd been a big part of the advocacy and organizing that had kept a large mining operation from coming to the town. Since moving to Aspen in 1984 to work at the Aspen Times, Paul has continued to write and shape narratives in the Aspen area around the environment, community, and human evolution. His latest book is about Nobel Peace Prize winner Albert Schweitzer and the birth of something called the Aspen Idea, which is about the intersection of mind, body, and spirit. Welcome, Paul. Thanks so much for having this conversation with me.
Thank you, Gwen.
I always love to hear how your own spiritual life has evolved for you. And I know that nature has been a big part of that. And maybe you could just sort of say how you got to where you are now and what that looks like.
So I grew up in a family of Methodists. I was confirmed in the Methodist Church according to the schedule of my family.
Right.
It's not something that ever really resonated with me, and in part I think is because I never really quite understood the value of it. No one really explained to me ever by sitting me down and telling me about spirit. What is spirit? It was always this mystery to me, and I never really understood the role of organized religion in that regard. So I after confirmation, I never went back to church. My church became nature and wilderness when I moved to Colorado in 1969 to go to school in Gunnison at Western State. That's where I first laid eyes on Crested Butte that summer of 69 and saw the elk range, and something moved inside me that I can only describe as a spiritual epiphany, that this was my spiritual home. So that's where it began for me.
Mm. So amazing. Yeah. And it's funny that we both landed in Crested Butte, having grown up different places. And I had a similar experience as you did. And over the years, one of the things that you have done is take people into nature. And as part of a seminar at the Aspen Institute, I wanted to hear a little bit about that and how the rights of nature factored into that. How did you connect people to that and then introduce the concept of the rights of nature?
When I was hired as a reporter at the Aspen Times in October of 84, I inherited the cast-off beats of the senior reporters, one of which was the Aspen Institute. And so I covered the Institute, and at that time the Institute was going through an identity crisis because the whole Meadows campus had been sold off to a developer in the late 80s, and the Institute had just really returned to Aspen, realizing that Aspen was essential to its identity. So I was brought in to the inside of the Institute to help be an intermediary between the town and Gown. And I did that very happily because I believed in the Institute and its practices, the executive seminar for one. And so I was reporting on a seminar called Retreat for Renewal. This is a Smithsonian pilot project. And one of the moderators was Charles Van Doren, a rather notorious academic figure who was the key figure in a film called Quiz Show. He discredited his family and himself by cheating on a televised quiz show. But Van Doren was a scholar. And at one session, we had discussed a Hemingway reading called The Big Two-Hearted River about nature and about a veteran of the U.S. military going into Idaho to catch fish and heal himself of his post-traumatic stress. So after that discussion, Van Doren instructed us to leave the seminar room, go outside. It was a beautiful summer day. And just to take in nature. He said, you can look at the small, something small and beautiful, like the leaves of a tree or an insect walking around, or you can take in a sublime distant vista. So I sat there and I recognized that the Institute was missing something very key to the site of Aspen. That is the nature experience. Mm-hmm. That led me to found, along with John Bennett, a former mayor of Aspen, and then a vice president of the Institute, the Nature and Society Seminar, taking corporate executives and educators and policymakers to the 10th Mountain Hut System in wilderness to immerse them in nature with the idea that that could shift their priorities in the decisions that they were making.
And do you have any stories or recollections of differences that you saw or were people sharing with you what a difference that made for them?
The people who came on these trips, many of them had never been in a wilderness. Mm. Many of them had not hiked more than a mile or two in their lives. So it was a huge learning curve for people. Physically, it was a rigor. Getting up to the Margisat from Lenedo, it was about an 8-mile walk, 2,700 vertical feet.
And that's a big deal.
It was a physical discipline that shook some people to their core. But it was a wonderful crucible, because once they transcended their physical limitations, they realized that they could do anything that they wanted, really. I think it gave them a sense of risk and daring and also confidence in themselves. That, coupled with a notebook of readings that we discussed all along the way, at intervals we would stop and bring out a reading of philosophy about nature. So the physical and the mental, the body and the mind, coalesced on these trips in a synthesis that enlivened the spirit.
Mm. And did you ever get to see how that experience changed their decision making?
No, or very rarely, because the Institute promised confidentiality.
Mm.
In fact, having anybody report on a seminar was breaking a kind of taboo at the Institute. They wanted it to be confidential so people could be free to speak whatever they chose and not be held accountable to it. So it was a liberating experience in that way, but then it kind of cloaked the results. But what I can tell you is that often after a seminar, and sometimes years later, I would bump into someone at the Institute in a gathering, and they would have been on one of those trips. And they would tell me that it was a remarkable experience that they'll never forget.
Mm. I, too, have been doing nature-based retreats for probably the last 10 years and really believe that helping leaders reclaim their innate relationship with the natural world is really a non-negotiable part of how we get to any viable future. And I think part of that is this emerging field that we see of rights of nature as a legal movement. How did you introduce people to that in any of your readings or experience with folks?
When I lived in Crested Butte and we fought the AMAX Mining Company in the late 70s and early 80s, this huge international mining conglomerate, certain people came to the fore there. One was Dr. Roderick Nash, author of a book titled The Rights of Nature, also the author of a book titled Wilderness and the American Mind. Rod Nash, a professor of ecological or biological philosophy at the University of California in Santa Barbara, Rod Nash became my co-moderator on these seminars, and we brought in his readings from his books that described the relationship of man and nature in a way that I had never understood before, and which most of the participants in the program had never understood, that the holistic connection is incredibly important for the health of both the human being and both the natural world. And the rights of nature are an extension of ethics and morality beyond the anthropocentric into the whole realm of nature. And this was something that really was a foreshadowing for me to the Albert Schweitzer mantra of reverence for life.
It's heartening to finally see this becoming something that's more articulated and, you know, certainly alive in the legal realm. And I wonder if you've seen firsthand any places where the rights of nature have been in play in civic action or anything that you've observed.
I think it's very rare, Gwen.
Yeah.
Most human beings still think anthropocentrically, that there's a hierarchy, and man is at the top of that hierarchy. Nature is secondary. And that's a bridge to cross. I don't see it being crossed now. Even in Pitkin County and Aspen, where, you know, it's supposedly very enlightened with a relationship to the natural world, there is still a long way to go before nature is accorded an equitable position with humanity. And yet it's vitally important that we embrace that if we hope to sustain the natural environment that supports us.
I absolutely agree. This is, just to take a quick break, this is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KDNK. My guest today is Paul Anderson. And we're talking about how the natural world is an important starting place for building our mind, body, spirit, wellness, and awareness.
Thinking a little bit more on your question, the Wilderness Act of 1964 is probably the strongest legislative acknowledgement of the rights of nature that has come to the fore so far. Even though it is often directed at human benefits, it still is a nod toward granting rights to a natural system that has no voice. When Thoreau went to Walden and wrote Walden, the first words of Walden, "I want to speak a word for nature." Mm-hmm. And nobody speaks for nature very much, but the Wilderness Act did. So, and we had very strong advocates in this valley that expanded the Maroon Belt Snowmass Wilderness and other wilderness areas and advocated very strongly. So there are examples.
That's a great one. Yeah, I feel like the leap that we're being asked to take to finally, you know, reclaim this innate part of ourself that is born and based in nature is a spiritual one. And when we get out in nature, we automatically feel that connection and that sense of awe that takes us out of our anthropocentric way of thinking. And it feels like these practices are so needed now in our lives to really make sure that we're feeding that connection.
And it's essential for our health and well-being.
Right.
There is a Japanese medical prescription. In Japanese, it is called Shinrin Yoku, and that translates literally to forest bathing. Japan probably has the highest stressed-out industrial workforce in the world, and when those workers hit their limit and suffer depression, anxiety, whatever their ills, they go to a physician who would prescribe Shinrin Yoku at a designated old-growth forest that are protected for that very reason. And you go there to be, not to do. You go there to be and just be among these living, beautiful organisms and take in their phytochemicals. I mean, it sounds pretty woo-woo, but it's true. Science is showing that exposure to green nature reduces the stress hormone cortisol. And that's proven. And medical science in the West is beginning to understand that exposure to nature is an essential for healing.
And you experienced this when you, and I think still do, take veterans out on wilderness experiences and found that it made a difference in their suicidal thoughts.
A follow-up to the wilderness seminar with the Institute was a program that I developed, a nonprofit, founded in 2013 called Huts for Vets. And the huts are the 10th Mountain Huts, and the vets are military veterans who have experienced trauma as a result of their service. Trauma more likely defined by moral injury and isolation. So we brought veterans out, and still do, to the mountains of Colorado. We bring them to, we fly them to Aspen often, and then take them to a base camp on a piece of agricultural land on East Soper's Creek, where there's no cell service. People camp out in tents, they sleep in a teepee, and then it's up to the 10th Mountain Huts for 3.5 days of hiking and discussing readings and gaining a new perspective. That's, I think, the most critical part, is that veterans who have been traumatized need to understand that they're part of something bigger, and that there is something larger than themselves that can give them succor. So on a mountaintop, for example, above Margie's hut, we do hour-long solos, and those veterans are there with no buffers, no cell service, only themselves and all of existence. And a solo is a difficult thing if you have demons clawing at the back of your head, and a lot of veterans do, but that is often the most important experience they will ever have on that trip, is coming to terms with themselves in this incredible landscape.
There's no way to not experience that connection on some level. And I think it must be that connection that makes us feel less alone. That is what Dr. Schweitzer talks about. That connection to universal consciousness, that connection to the divine, where we realize there's no way that we're separate from anything. We're inherently connected and belong.
Yeah, John Muir wrote many years ago, or said, the more I learn about things in nature, the more I realized everything is hitched to everything else.
Right.
And he, through observation, saw this. We're limited in that opportunity for observation today because of the huge urban centers where most people live and rarely have the opportunity to even see the night sky.
Mm-hmm.
It's all washed out with ambient light. There's very little access to pristine landscapes. And yet, Shinrin Yoku forest bathing is still possible, even in a city park, by sitting under a tree. So there are degrees. But my ambition would be to bring as many people as possible to experience a wild setting and to feel the energy of it and to feel themselves in a place that they don't control. Because wilderness it comes from the Old English word wildior, which is untamed, uncontrolled. So there's a sense of beauty to this uncontrolled, natural experience.
Not man-made.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about Dr. Schweitzer and what you feel like his real contribution was to Aspen at that time and, you know, maybe now.
Yeah, so Schweitzer, it's such an unusual story that he came to Aspen on his one and only visit to the United States.
Right.
He was offered an honorarium to give a keynote address at the Goethe Bicentennial in 1949. And he was in Africa at his Bush Hospital serving the most underserved population you can imagine. And he wanted to construct a leprosy clinic. The offer of $6,000 would allow him to do that. So even though he was in his 70s, he was 74 years old, and his wife and he were not in great health, they accepted the invitation, and they came to the United States by ship. They landed in New York and were lauded by the media. The media called Albert Schweitzer the living saint because he had renounced his European privilege and became a physician at age of 30 and gave his life to selfless service. By train, they went to Chicago, and here Dr. Schweitzer was just abused of a misunderstanding. Because all the stationery he had received came from the University of Chicago, he thought Aspen was a suburb. He was told, no, you have to go 1,000 miles further west, up to 8,000 feet. So he did it. He and his wife came on the train, and they arrived in Glenwood Springs and were delivered to Aspen. And he said, Aspen ist zu nah an den Himmel gebaut. Aspen is built too close to heaven. He found it beautiful, but he was also a little afraid that it could take him here. And anyway, he survived. He gave this address and set Aspen on a moral and ethical course that I think has never been equaled, except maybe by a visit by the Dalai Lama in the 1980s.
Mm. What was it that sparked what has become known as the Aspen Idea?
It's a bit of conceit to call it the Aspen Idea because the Greeks understood the division of humanity. The Trinity also is a tripartite division of man, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And in the Thessalonians, Paul, in a letter to the Thessalonians, writes to them that they can be assured of safety in converting to Christianity because they will be protected in body, mind, and spirit. So this is an ancient idea. But in Aspen, it was really, it originated as a philosophical concept and sort of a guiding light because the Goethe Bicentennial was held in 49, just 4 years after World War II, after Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the Holocaust, after the war deaths of 50 to 85 million human beings, and the birth of the nuclear age. I mean, this was a critical time. We think we live in dangerous times now. We do. But that time was particularly perilous. And people wanted something to latch onto that would be comforting. So the exploration of the whole self, the whole person, body, mind, and spirit, like a three-legged stool, giving three legs to support the human experience.
I always like to ask guests, coming back to, you know, sort of your own spiritual practice, your own ways of keeping yourself whole and well. And I wonder what is something that maybe you are personally working on these days and how your practices help to support that.
5 weeks ago, I had a medical crisis. My left kidney ruptured because of a tumor blocking my ureter. And I was airlifted from Valley View Hospital in a helicopter to St. Mary's. Three surgeries later, I am here now, but just beginning a process that is going to be a long road for me. So I am prepping myself for a long travail and a long healing experience. Today, this morning, I set out from my home. I live up the Frying Pan Valley. And in my backyard is the most incredible landscape of these canyons and cliffs. And so I hiked up to this beautiful ledge where I have often gone to sit. And it's way above the valley. And I noticed on this ledge two bighorn sheep standing there watching me. And I noticed across the valley a large bird, it was a bald eagle, catching thermals and rising up on the wind that was blowing today. And then I hike over across this landscape to another castle, another cliff ledge, and I sit there on a seat that I've made years ago. And I sit there and I'm just quietly appreciating everything that's around me, and especially the quiet, but the trees. I'm noticing every tree now, in part because I'm looking for mountain lions. On the way down my hike, I go through a little chimney of rock, and I notice mountain lion tracks that are going down before me. So I come home from an experience like that, and I am so grateful for the ability to be in a natural setting like that, that is so wild, and that so infuses me with a life force. So that's my practice right now.
That's a beautiful one. Yeah, I mean, and certainly, you know, the state of gratitude that it puts you in is likely, you know, one of the most powerful healing states possible.
I think so.
I wish you lots more of that, Paul, as you get better and return to 100%.
Yeah, thank you.
If people want to find your books or your latest book, where should they go?
You know, I think the Schweitzer book is at White River Books.
In Carbondale?
In Carbondale.
Yep.
Yeah,
okay.
And then it certainly is at Explore Booksellers and Carl's Pharmacy.
In Aspen. Great.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I don't know if they're available on, you know, on any site. I haven't looked, but I want this book to be out because I think this book should be in every home in the Roaring Fork Valley. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people could even contact me or maybe through you, and I would offer some books to people who are interested.
Beautiful. So you can get in touch with me through my website, gwen@gwengarcelon.com, or on the Facebook page for The Inner Game, and I can make those connections. And thank you so much for this conversation, Paul. Thank you all for listening today. You can find The Inner Game on Apple Podcasts and on the kdnk.org website. And like I said, on my website, gwengarcelon.com. The music is Peter Mayer's song, Awake. And until next time, here's a Schweitzer quote from Paul's book, Do Good for the Pure Love of the Good.